Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy, and we've got Kevin Kelleher with us today. Kevin Kelleher is the international award-winning editorial cartoonist for The Economist Magazine of London and the Baltimore Sun. In a distinguished career that spans 36 years, Cal has created over 8,000 cartoons and 140 magazine covers. His resume includes a half a dozen collections of his published work. His most recent book of Economist cartoons, Daggers Drawn, was published in 2013. Cal has garnered international honors and awards in 7 countries, and his art has been exhibited in 10. He has created acclaimed animations and calendars, toured the U.S. with the Second City Improv Comedy Troupe, and addressed audiences around the world. Cal, a Newark, Connecticut native and Harvard graduate, is currently the artist in residence at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. In 1999, the World Encyclopedia of Cartoons said of Kevin, "Commanding a masterful style, Kelleher stands among the premier caricaturists of the 20th century." I hope it's the 21st century, too.
That's right. Maybe even the 22nd.
Okay, there you go. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Cal.
It's great to be here, man.
Tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words.
Most people know me as Cal, as the editorial cartoonist. We're here for the Baltimore Sun, for the people based in the Baltimore area. But then also I have a large audience around the world, and those are the readers for The Economist magazine, which is published in London but is distributed around the world. So it's a pretty rare combination, actually, to be a cartoonist in 2 different countries and 2 different cultures, 2 completely different audiences. It's also very rare that a cartoonist would, well, these days even have a job, because so many cartoonists are being laid off as newspapers are beginning to be diminishing. But I've been very lucky. I have published, like we said, 8,000 cartoons. And I started actually just out of college. I went to school here, as you described, in the U.S., and then led a bicycle tour to the U.K. back in 1977. And ended up staying there for 11 years, playing semi-pro basketball and eventually getting my first job with the
Who'd
Economist.
You play with?
I played with the Brighton Bears.
Great.
The basketball powerhouse. And but I had the good fortune of basketball did allow me to travel a lot and play with players all around the world and have a great experience. And then back in 1986, I was in Washington, D.C., for a cartoonist convention. And I met a guy at a cocktail party. He said there might be a job going into the Baltimore Sun. So I put in my application. They offered me a job. And at the time, there was this brand new thing. I don't know if you've heard of it, called the internet.
Vaguely familiar.
Yeah, it is, yes.
Yeah. So, we might have to go into that.
That's right. And they said, maybe there's a way that you could, you know, still work for The Economist, come to Baltimore, and then use the internet to deliver your cartoons. So we came over, my wife and kids, and we came over here for a trial, and for a 2-year trial, and it's been 27 years, and so we're still here. So I think the trial has been resolved.
Talk a little bit more in detail about, I'd like to talk about the basketball. How did you get into that?
So I was playing, I played a basketball at Harvard. I played, in those days, boy.
Wait a minute, back up. You played basketball at Harvard?
Yeah, at Harvard.
That's great.
And I played the freshman team, and they had a team that was like a JV team, because in those days, the freshmen couldn't play varsity, and then they had a JV team. So I played club ball for them, for a team called the Harvard Classics. We used to tour. We used to tour during spring break and play teams around the world. And so when the season finished, my basketball coach was actually teaching a basketball clinic in the U.K. And at the Brighton Bears was looking for an American, because in those days, each team would have 2 foreigners, and they almost always were Americans. These days, with the advent of growth of basketball around the world, many times the foreigners can be of any nationality because there's so many good ones. So they were looking for 2 Americans, and the guy said, "Was an American on a bicycle?" He's in Ireland at the moment, cycling around. If you could find him, he'd probably be willing to join you. So they found me, and I joined them, and it was a great experience. And I brought a few other friends, basketball players' friends, to come and join us play as well.
So you were there 11 years?
I played for 3, and then coached as well at the same time, and then left and stayed in the UK for 11 years.
You said you got to travel. What were some of the places you went to? basketball career?
Oh, in a basketball career, well, mostly it was in Europe because I was playing with all-star teams. There'd be so many tournaments at the end of the season. And the basketball seasons there for the teams was a little bit like our pro seasons. We would play, my gosh, we'd play 50 games or some huge amount of basketball games. And then the seasons would extend into the summer, so it was a really long time. So there would be tournaments that we'd play throughout Europe, which was great. But what I really enjoyed was playing against players from around the world. Because when you're on the court, it doesn't matter what language you're speaking. You know, you're playing the sport becomes your delivery system, and you communicate with these guys in these nonverbal ways. And I have distinctly remember, for example, playing the Korean national team in a game where nobody was above 6'5", but they all played fantastic and great defense, and it was so much fun playing against them. And then playing against a team from Czechoslovakia at the time when they were behind the Iron Curtain, and they had all these bodyguards that were basically keeping them separate from everybody else, so none of them would defect, I guess. That was so much fun.
Sounds interesting. You going to write a book about it?
Boy, I have to find an author to do it. I'm too busy. Get somebody. Somebody wants to come and write it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Let's go back even more. Did you always want to be a cartoonist, or how did that evolve?
You know, I always like to draw, and I do have some early memories of drawing, including, I remember, in first grade, being really good at drawing dinosaurs. And everyone in the first grade class wanted me to draw a dinosaur for them. And I would say, no, you can learn how to do a dinosaur. And so I would, you know, put the dots on the paper, say, just connect these dots, and you become like, so you can learn how to. And I just assumed that everybody could draw. And a little while later, I was realizing that not everyone could draw, that maybe what I could do was not what everybody else could do. But I also learned that there was other people who were always better at drawing than I was, and, you know, even in the art classes and so on. And so I would always work at it, you know, work at it particularly hard that I really wanted to do well. But I never took a formal class in art until I was a junior in high school. And I did cartoons for my high school newspaper, and then eventually also when I went to university, did cartoons for my college newspaper. When you're a political cartoonist, you're combining two different elements. You know, you have you have to have the understanding of the politics and the writing, and then you have the drawing side. You have to have a skill set that's pretty finely tuned to be a good artist. So the art side, you know, was kind of slow in coming along. But the humor side was something that always kind of was with me, because our family growing up always liked to laugh. Dinner time was always, you know, usually a bunch of laughs. And so we were – our parties and the family gatherings were always great. Your stomach was hurting usually by the end of the whole thing. So the sense of humor was something that was kind of – oh, and the sense of playfulness was something that was, I think, always ingrained growing up. But the political side really didn't come to me till I was, you know, maybe halfway through college, and more acutely when I was living abroad. Because, you know, when you're an American living abroad, you are held personally responsible for everything that goes on in this country.
Well, tell me about it.
Yeah. And so I, you know, and also, you know, I was in London at the time, I remember, and any taxi driver you talked to would know more about American politics than most Americans you talked to. And so I started getting more interest into the realm of politics, and I started to study political cartoonists more, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to combine my interest in art and politics? But I tell you, the one of the more crucial moments I do recall was back in college. And when I was at Harvard, the Watergate was just breaking. And I remember getting the Boston Globe every day and looking at the front page, and it was, you know, full of all this stuff that you knew was really important. But it was hard to make heads or tail over who was what and what was going on. But then I'd go and turn to the political cartoon. And there, in a delicious capsule of information, I was able to see the faces of the various characters, you know, who was probably the bad guys, who was the good guys. You kind of figure the whole thing out. Plus, there's a chance you're going to have a bit of a giggle, and the drawings were always interesting. So I thought, isn't this amazing that in this little tablet form that you were able to, you know, get all this incredibly strong medicine? So that got me excited about the prospects of what cartoons could be, and made me, you know, thought that maybe wouldn't this be a fun way to go? Although my first passion, when I thought I was going to be an animator or a comic strip guy.
So then in college, you started getting paid for cartoons yet?
No, so I was doing cartoons. In fact, it was just the opposite. I'll tell you what happened. I was I did cartoons for the we had a weekly paper called The Independent. I did cartoons there. I did cartoons for the daily paper called The Crimson. And my senior thesis was a 13-minute long animated cartoon based on a comic strip that I had in the Crimson called The Days of Disgustus, which was about a Roman guy named Caesar Disgustus and stuff. But I had this passion for caricature, you know. It part started when I was at doing an art class, and we had to go to the Boston Fine Arts Museum to draw a painting. And I stumbled upon a room full of little caricature busts by the famous artist Daumier. And these are fabulous little figurines that he had originally created out of clay that he was using as models of real politicians, so that when he needed to draw them later, he would use these little figurines. Mm-hmm. They later were cast. And so I was looking at these casts. I was mesmerized by these things. And I said, how do you learn to be a caricaturist? How do you do it? There's no school for caricature, right?
Right.
So the only way you do it is by looking at other caricaturists. So I knew that guys used to do it on the street. So I used to go into Harvard Square. I'd set up two chairs and a little sign. I'd say, your caricature for free. Because I couldn't charge anybody. I was so bad. And I was just learning. And so
they couldn't complain.
They couldn't complain.
What do you want for nothing?
That's right. It was nothing. But here's the deal is that instead of getting people saying, oh, I'd love to have my caricature on, I got every person who wanted to proselytize me to come and sit down. They finally said, oh, here's a person who's willing to listen to me for 5 minutes, you know, while I draw them. So anyways, it was the beginning of a long journey, which I'm still on, of trying to master the world of caricature.
So how did you develop your own style in terms of the drawings themselves? Mm. Now you said you had other people with influence and how they did it. Did you have your own clay model or something like that?
Well, I have done clay models. In fact, I normally do when a new president comes along, I play, make some clay, because I think it's good for mapping their face in your mind. But coming, this notion of style is really interesting. You know, when I tell people, when kids learn or used to learn how to do handwriting in school at age seven or eight, whenever people would learn, the natural progression is that they copy the teacher first. Then within a week, they copy the kid in the class who's got the coolest handwriting. But then 10 years later, everybody's handwriting is completely different and they can't even help it. It happens. Right. And they stop copying people and it just starts to pour out of them. And the same thing happens with art, I imagine. I imagine it happens with music and other artists as well. And in my case, you know, you first look at there are certain people whose work inspires you. And you say, wow, isn't it interesting they did that? And you kind of copy it because you learn by imitation. And then you become your style becomes a bit of a mutt where you like this guy for this and this girl for that. And then their styles kind of merge into yours. But then over time, your signature, your handwriting, your look kind of oozes out of you and it becomes, you know, your take on things rather than a deliberate journey that you're sort of saying, oh, I want to end up here. That's the way it worked for me. Mm-hmm. It's also curious that I was inspired both by the artists in Europe and the artists in America. So I've got a kind of a bit of a transatlantic style where, you know, the people in Europe say, well, you've got an American style, but people in America say, oh, you've got a European style. Where I take interesting areas from both.
Well, see, that's the thing about as you're American living abroad, you have a different perspective and you incorporate that in everything that you do.
I agree.
From here on in. It's interesting to me, how has it emerged? How different is it 36 years ago to now? And were there moments that it became different or was it just a gradual evolution?
Mm. Well, I think with the cartoons, an amazing concoction, political cartoon, because it involves all these different tools, these different skill sets. You know, you're a journalist, you're a satirist, you're a columnist, and then you're an artist. So you wear all these different hats. And during the course of one's career, certain parts of that equation is weaker and certain parts are stronger. And then over time, hopefully, you know, when you get to my stage where I've been doing this for 36 years, that all five of those categories are firing at a high level. But as you're going along, you know, you might be really good at the art, but your journalism is a little behind. Or then you might be good as a satirist, but you know, you don't know what to talk about. You know, so you're constantly building. And every cartoon I do is a practice for the next cartoon you do. And you learn a lesson from today's that you're going to do tomorrow. Mm. And one of the magical parts of this job is you have a brand new blank piece of paper every day to start from. So you get to start fresh. For me, when I first was coming along and I look back at my early work, it was a rough diamond that needed a lot of work polishing. At the time, I didn't know that it was a diamond. You didn't know if it had potential. You had all these hopes and aspirations. But in time, I've been lucky to be able to polish it as it goes along.
What was easier for you, the form or the content?
Well, I think they both have their unique challenges. The content challenge is when you're first starting off is that the world's a big place with lots of stuff going on and you don't know it. And there's a lot of people who know more about it than you do. And so you have to spend a lot of time reading, talking to people, listening, absorbing. And one of the advantages of spending several decades in this craft is that you do accumulate a pretty good bedrock foundation of knowledge of what's happening and how people are and what goes on in politics and the world and so on, and that you can call upon. It's wisdom, I guess. You kind of, one of the few things that gets better as you get older as you accumulate wisdom. But even at that time, one of the things I know today is to know what I don't know and be able to then either know where I can find the information, know who I can call, who I can turn to, you know, what bloggers I need to read, what articles I need to look at, whose information I can trust to get to the nub of what I think the important issues are. So that has definitely gotten easier over time. And the drawing in some ways has also gotten easier over time. Now, when I say easier, what I mean is that I have a very set amount of time. I work on a very tight deadline. You know, you might start at 10 and you've got to have that thing finished by, say, 6 p.m., and it's going to be read by several million people, and it's going to have your name on it. So it's got to look good. What happens is you become a very efficient decision maker. You become very quick in your ability to draw. And also because you've done this, you know, several thousand times before, you already have an inclination of what things may work, what things may not work. And then also just with the accumulation of time, you get better at drawing. So today, I'm better at drawing cows than I was 10 years ago. And 10 years from now, I should be better at drawing cows than I am today.
And an expert still at dinosaurs, right?
And you should see my dinosaurs, man. So, you know, your skill set improves.
Take me through, you touched on it, your daily artistic process.
Right.
How do you find ideas? I mean, there's a plethora of them, like you said, but how do you go about throwing out stuff, including stuff, or getting the final idea of what you want to have come across?
I'm fortunate in that I don't have a daily routine. And what I mean is that every day is different for me. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that. Some people love routines. I'm a guy who just loves variety. So I do a weekly editorial cartoon for the Baltimore Sun. I do 2 to 3 cartoons a week for The Economist. I have other freelance jobs that I do as well. I'm an artist in residence, and I work with students at UMBC. I make animations. I do all sorts of fun, interesting, diverse projects. So what I think I'll mention to you is how would I approach a political cartoon if I had to draw one today?
Okay,
that's probably, you know, because I confront that situation. And when I was working,
you ask better questions.
Well, and the thing is that I'm a complicated guy here, I guess. But I also, when I was doing daily cartoons at the Baltimore Sun, you know, I did. You had a specific kind of routine that you had to do. The first thing is that you have to be up on what's happening in the news and have an inclination of what you want to talk about. And what you want to talk about is not what's funny in the news today, but what's important in the news. And how do you feel about that subject? Mm-hmm. Because in the end, you're really kind of a commentator. You know, you're putting your points across. So there's a lot of research involved. There's a lot of reading, trying to keep up with what's going on, and trying to determine where you're going to land today. Then I probably spend the next 3 to 4 hours scratching around on the ideas. And the ideas are sprung out of your left brain fighting with your right brain, the kind of a titanic battle of the neurons flashing back and forth, as the logical side of yourself says, well, this is exactly what's happening. And you jump to some sort of conclusions. But then the creative half of your brain is saying, ooh, that sounds like this. And ooh, wouldn't it be funny if that? And oh, I would love to see this guy drawn like this. And so you play back and forth trying to honor the truth and the factual nature of the comment you're trying to do, but at the same time indulge the playful side of your brain to do something interesting, to try to portray your idea in a engaging fashion. So that can take, like I said, 3 to 4 hours of sketching. I'm thinking always with a piece of paper in front of me, because there are ideas I've discovered that sound great in your head, but the second you start to draw them, they fall flat. And then other ideas that in your head may not be fully formed and don't have that much going for it. But then as you start to draw, you see opportunities and possibilities and it comes alive. So my sketches I have are very hieroglyphic in the beginning. And then in time, I build them up and evolve them till I get a finished pencil sketch. And that would be a sketch that would be the same size that I'm going to draw. We'd have all the caricatures done. And at that point, I will scan it and email that to my editor, whether it's in London for The Economist or here in Baltimore for the mm-hmm. Baltimore Sun, and say, hey, this is what I'm hoping to do today. What do you think? And 95% of the time, they write back and say, that sounds great. Go for it. And at that point, I spend the next 3 hours, sometimes longer, 4 hours, just applying the ink to the drawings. Because my drawings are highly detailed. I use old pen nibs where you dip it in a bottle of ink, and then you scratch, 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 mm-hmm. and dip in a bottle, scratch, scratch, scratch. And that process creates, I hope, a kind of engaging look to the drawings, because the whole time what I'm trying to do is hold a reader for about 8 or 9 seconds,
right,
onto your thing. And hopefully at that time they will absorb all of that stuff and you honor them by giving them a nice drawing.
But also you're making them think too afterwards.
So exactly.
It's a residual thing that you have to be accountable.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, you are, because I really, I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing you. You're kind enough to come on, but I really like your editorial.
Thank you.
It's really great.
That.
They really come to the point, because it's to me, it's very tough in terms that you have to portray it using something else and making it look kind of something sometimes kind of ridiculous.
Yes.
Because you're using a frame of reference that is not normally used. And so you're coming back into that, and people, it's a universal thing. So people all over can see, you know, what you're trying to do.
Mm.
In terms of the process, it must be pretty exciting. But and at this point, and 36 years later, too, that you're so disciplined at doing it, that you have to get it done by a certain time. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting, but is it still kind of scary for you?
They can get scary.
What about that 5%?
Yeah, that's right.
And say,
well, I think what happens is that you of course, your bar is now higher, too, mm-hmm. is that you have to it's like going up. I'm going to use a baseball metaphor. Now, cartoons, we use lots of metaphors, so I feel comfortable. So imagine if you are, an all-star, perennial all-star, and home run champion. Well, they expect you every time you come up to bat to hit a home run. And if you hit a single, people are disappointed. Okay? So the pressure comes is that you have to, go on that to that highest level. And, I love that challenge. That kind of keeps the juices going. So even when you know that you can complete a decent cartoon by 6 o'clock, doesn't mean that you're going to be completely happy with it every time. You want to keep on doing your very best work and give yourself new challenges to push you along. But there's also this other thing. One of the reasons why this job to me is so exciting, and so I'm so honored and privileged to have to do this, is that when important things are going on in the country, when the important things are going on in Maryland, and when important things are going on here in the city of Baltimore, you have a chance to be right in the middle of the discussion, mm-hmm. to maybe even further the discussion if you possibly can, engaging people and raising issues and certainly provoking thought, as you mentioned, on these important subjects of the day. It doesn't happen all the time, but when that happens, you know that you know this is a really special platform that I have.
You said it before. It's making something clear in 8 seconds. You don't have to read 3 pages of something to try to understand. And it's thought-provoking. It makes, whether you are on that side or not, you have to think, well, that's true, too. Mm-hmm. So, that's got to be a consideration. So right. It begs for open thinking.
It does.
So, which is amazing. And to take the baseball metaphor a little farther, I really like your stuff. Mm. And if you were a baseball player, I think you would be $100 million a year at 30 years,
Dang.
And I could be your agent.
I'm in the wrong business.
Because you do better than 3 out of 10.
Oh, that's good. That's right. Well, that's the thing about baseball. You only need to do 3 out of 10 good ones.
It's true. Failure is all right.
Yeah, right.
We talked about your cartoons and your caricaturists as a caricaturist. And you said you're very busy with other things. Go in a little detail about what you're doing right now.
Yeah. Well, last year, about this time, I had came out with a great book, 35 years of cartoons with the Economist, called Daggers Drawn. And it was a really big project. I had a Kickstarter campaign, raised $100,000, pre-sold 2,000 copies to 46 different countries. Then followed up with touring both in the U.S. and around the globe, speaking to audiences and doing the book. And so I'm still doing some of that, which is really exciting, a chance to get out and talk to people and see some of the people who've been enjoying the cartoons over the years. That's been great. I also do this. One of my most favorite things that I do is I'm artist in residence at UMBC. Now, UMBC is, the jewel and the crown of Maryland's higher education institution. And it's right here, right outside Baltimore. And it's such a great place to be, great energy. And I work with an elite group of students, maybe about 10 to 12 students. And we do a daily current events blog. And I edit it, and I work with these students, and they turn out terrific work, and I really enjoy it. It's read mostly by students, but it's on the web for everyone to read. It's called usdemocrazy.com. Mm-hmm. It's one word, usdemocrazy.com. So that's super fun, and these kids are really great and really smart and doing some fun stuff. And then I do a load of other interesting projects. For those of you out there who are familiar with the Raven beers, there is a beer called the Raven, but there's also Telltale Heart Ale and Pendulum Pilsner. If you go to the bars or if you go to the off licenses and you see those, I did the labels on those.
All right.
I have the Edgar Allan Poe's face there. That's a Cal thing. And we've got great plans and great hopes and aspirations for those lines of beers and what this might mean for the Poe merchandising and so on. So that's all very exciting. And then in about a month's time, I'm going to spend the summer as an artist in residence in Bermuda, if you can believe that.
It's tough.
It's going to be quite interesting. So this thing, I got to set
the record
straight.
How do you prepare for that?
So anyways, the situation with this, it sounds grand, and it is a terrific opportunity. I'm really looking forward to it. But what it is they don't pay you. They give you an apartment in a basement apartment, and you get a visa for 3 months to do a project that you propose, and then you have a big exhibition at the National Museum, and you sell the work, and that ideally will cover the cost of your time there because it's extremely expensive to live there. They don't pay for your flights or anything. You find your way there and you got down. And the proposal I made to them was being a satirist and cartoonist, that I would go and interview scores of Bermudians and then do a series of cartoons, each of those cartoons from the perspective of a different Bermudian. So you could get a sense of where the people think about their island and what they're doing today. And the good news is I can also carry on doing my cartoons every week for The Economist and The Baltimore Sun from there. Yeah. So I'll be doing that. And so it'll be quite interesting because I'll be putting on my journalist hat a little bit like you. I'll be sitting interviewing people and learning something about it. And then try to get a peel back behind the curtain and see what's going on in Bermuda.
Well, maybe we can talk to you. sometime. You know, I can do it by Skype or something like
that.
You know, in midsummer and just see how you're getting on and tell me what's going on. That'd be terrific.
Sure. Yeah, we'll have some, I'll tell you what, we'll have some stories to tell. I can promise you that.
That'd be great. That's terrific. So you mentioned also some film work that you're doing, some videos. Talk about that.
Animation, yeah. So when I graduated from Harvard, you know, I mentioned I'd done this 13-minute-long animation, animated cartoon. And then in the course of time, I've done other animation work. My one of my favorite pieces was back in 1986 where I did a TV commercial in the UK with Richard Williams, who went on to be the animation director for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And that film won a couple of awards. And so back in 2006, I think it was, I started up my own little local animation production company to do, you know, specifically trying to create the opportunity for satirical political cartoons. And I've done, we've done some pretty fun stuff, particularly in the 2008 election cycle. I worked with, starting with stuff that we'd built at UMBC, trying to create 3D animation that would work in real time. I eventually took this technology and toured with Second City, the improv comedy troupe, doing live shows where I would create, say, a 3D version of George W. Bush that would appear on a screen, but I would be backstage in a motion capture suit and moving, so
at the same time,
make it go live. And then there would be voice, we'd have voice recognition, so I could, you know, when I talked, his mouth would move as well. Oh, so we do live.
Modern technology.
Yeah, modern. We do kind of an interaction with the audience, and that was kind of fun. And then more recently, I've done a series of 2D animated stuff for The Economist on a series of economic terms that is kind of quasi-educational stuff. So I'm looking to try to find more ways to be able to make political cartoons and just animation in general, be able to break down the barriers of this, of what's complicated in both American politics and world politics, but also in educational fashions like economics, and using cartoons as a way to deliver that.
So that comes to my next question. How do you see yourself, say, well, I mean, it would probably be the same 3 months down the road and 5 years down the road?
Yeah.
And also, is there anything that you haven't done that you, in the back of your mind, you really would like to do?
Well, you know, I first of all, I have so much fun doing so many different things. I guess one project I forgot to tell you is, you know, there's a group in town called BIG, Baltimore Improv Group. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing some work with them, and I'm doing a show with them at the end of May, you know, here in town. And so you do some live drawing, improv drawing and stuff like that. So I wear all these different hats, and it's just so much fun and exciting. But then, having said that, there's still some fun projects that I'd love to be able to do. I'd still love to be able to pursue the notion of doing and eventually a weekly cartoon, animated cartoon. It may not be very long. It might be a minute. It might be 2 to 3 minutes. I have a great belief in that this is going to be the future of visual satire, and people, when it's done well, are going to gobble it up big time. It reminds me of what the world was like before Doonesbury. When, if somebody said to you, I've got this political strip that we could run in the newspaper, we would say, no way. And then it comes along and goes gangbusters, takes over everything. Before Jon Stewart came along, people said, I've got the satirical television show that talks about every day. We talk about the day's news. Everyone would say, no way. Well, look where we are now. And I believe what's going to happen with political animation is the same thing. When it's done right, when people see it done proper sort of way, they're just going to love this, because they'll see it, and they can look, they could spend a minute on their cell phone every morning or their iPad or whatever device they're looking at. But the difference between doing an animated cartoon and what you see my normal political cartoons is it takes more time, it takes more money, it takes more people. And so as a result, the initial costs go up. But if you can find a way to get revenue from it, you know, whether either subscriptions or ads or whatever, then it becomes worthwhile. But once the first one is successful, the floodgates will open, and then everybody will want to get a piece and want to do that kind of thing.
You know, I can understand that, because I have this internet radio station.
Yeah.
It's starting out.
That's right.
But the other thing is, it just occurred to me that it's kind of like when computers came out, too.
Yeah.
And they were all $5,000 or something like that. Yeah. Now you can be $200, $300 for, you know, something very small. I think that would happen with that too. It costs now, but as the technology advances,
right,
that in, you know, who knows how many year time,
that's
hopefully
right,
in our lifetime,
yeah,
that, you know, you can do it in just a few seconds and for a few bucks.
Yeah, you could do some, you know, some quality. And at the end of the day, the writing is the key component.
Right.
You know, you have to be the good writing in this, in the satire is what it's all about. Because right now, you know, you talked about Jon Stewart, is that, you know, these guys are basically cartoonists. They, every half an hour show they do is equivalent to about 10 political cartoons in there. And when I listen to their shows, and I listen to them and watch them all the time, is that I go, oh, there's that gag. Oh, there's that gag. Oh, there's that gag. And can't use that one. Can't use that one anymore. But they're great, and they do great writing. But there's no reason to say that when you get to animated political cartoons, we do the same.
I haven't asked this because I'm trying not to be too political. In the last 36 years, do you have a favorite regime that you wrote under?
Ah, well, I tell you what, there was. Oh man, you know that's a tough one. I'm not going to say one because I'll tell you what. I'll tell you about several people. Because at first, I opened up with Margaret Thatcher. I lived a decade in the UK under Margaret Thatcher. So wow, I mean, talk about a formidable woman leader who's really, you know, amazing, impressive, you know, leader. But I didn't agree with her on so many things. But what distinguished her from the modern politicians that we see is that she said she was going to do something, and she did it.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
She just went and did it. And she wasn't trying to play the political games that you kind of find. But she was also, wow, great fodder for cartoons because she just was going in one direction all the time. And boy, it was a really tumultuous time to be in the UK, so it was good. And then her cross-Atlantic partner, Ronald Reagan, my gosh, interesting character because of, you know, everyone in this country has got their own feelings about them. But I noticed the difference that the U.S. felt about him or portrayed him, shall we say, and the way that Europe portrayed him. Because in Europe, he was portrayed as this kind of evil, dumb character. Well, over here, he was perceived as a kind of a grandfatherly, you know, aw shucks kind of guy.
Straight shooter.
Straight, you know, completely different views. So it was interesting for me to draw cartoons during that time. Then we go to Bill Clinton, and he, of course, just, my gosh, you know, he just was always supplying, you know, us with material. And he was both, you know, at an interesting time, but he was also, to me, the most infuriating guy. Because a man of enormous potential and enormous brains and enormous smarts, who basically, it was all about Bill. It was, in the end of the day, it was all about Bill. And he just was, you know, very hedonistic and narcissistic. And I think that was a kind of blown opportunity, but great for cartoons. And then George W. Bush, who I think will probably go down in history as one of the worst presidents in our time, and who oversaw an historic period in American history and probably made a lot of wrong moves. But it was an interesting time to be a cartoonist, too.
And he's a painter now.
Yeah, and he's a painter now. And then Barack Obama, who's another disappointing one. Yeah, so they all supply their certain material.
This has been terrific, by the way. I really appreciate you coming in. It's just been, I mean, we could do about 100 shows, which I, you know, maybe we shall do, you know.
Sure.
But this is an introduction.
Yep.
So
great.
I just want to ask you, is there anything else you want to add?
Nothing that I can – well, I just want to add that I'm grateful to all the people who have been reading cartoons all these years. You know, people here in Baltimore have been great supporters, and there's still so much that I need to learn, and I'm always willing to listen. So friend me on Facebook and, you know, spread the word and buy the book, daggersdrawn.com. I mean, you can come and order a copy of the book, and I'll sign it for you.
Well, we're going to give you – links to your website and getting the books and everything like that.
Okay.
But give out a little contact info.
Okay. Yeah. So my best website is caltoons.com, www.caltoons.com. And there, you know, got a bunch of stuff up there. It needs to be updated more, but I'll get around to that. And the book is called Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal's Cartoons in The Economist.
Well, thank you, Kevin Kelleher, for being here on Baltimore Internet Radio. I've been talking to Cal, Kevin Kelleher, a cartoonist, caricaturist. Jeez, you know, and I rehearsed that, too.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. He does videos. He teaches at the UMBC. A man of many talents. What I like is that he's continually learning, just like all of us. That's terrific. Yeah. Thank you for your art, and thanks for bringing it to Baltimore.
I'm glad to be here.
This is Dave Custy. You've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.